Chris Cornell, welcome to Birmingham.
Thank you.
The rock hotbed of Birmingham. Are you aware of the musical heritage of this area?
Well, not really, other than Black Sabbath.
Well, yeah.
And the reason why Black Sabbath is just because I remember interviews where Ozzy would talk about their what it was like growing up here,
mm-hmm.
and how that influenced their music and made it, you know, well, at the time, you know, they didn't intentionally do it, but there was a lot of kind of good feeling hippie wood clogs, you
mm-hmm.
know, and flower stickers on the VW Beetle.
That's right. Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they didn't have those feelings and you know, cause they weren't from that kind of a place. And that I always liked that, you know, because I always felt like that. I felt like, certainly Soundgarden is a product of its environment, and we would get sort of made fun of and be called Frown Garden and stuff because we were just kind of appeared to be grumpy and our music wasn't particularly happy, and that kind of that wave of Britpop that happened too, that was sort of the first thing that I remember resonating was that why is everyone writing songs that are so depressing? And I remember thinking then, it's like, fair enough. Like, there's been enough of that, so I get it. On the other hand, why aren't people writing songs that are more about depressing themes? Because I don't really see the beautiful brightness in the world. So anyway, that's what I think of when I think of Birmingham. I also had a...
well, you see, that makes sense because...
I had a tour manager from Birmingham, too, that I spent a lot of time with. That was Soundgarden's tour manager and Alice in Chains' tour manager named Kevin Wilkins. And he was a great guy, and I had a lot of fun with him. That's the other thing I think of when I think of Birmingham is Kevin.
Well, you see, Sabbath, they're a product of this area because it's an industrial landscape.
Yeah.
And, of course, Tony Iommi, he was working in a foundry, chopped the tips off his fingers at the time.
As you do.
He was a steel worker.
Yeah, in a foundry.
Yeah, and then he made those little plastic fingers.
Which I didn't know was
created
a kid,
the sound.
But, yeah, it's the only thing
exactly.
that sounds like that.
But not only Sabbath, half of Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
Because Robert Plant,
and John Bonham,
all from around here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was saying thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, I
because,
get it.
Because you're in the locality. Yeah, I mean, not I that it. You've got to win the locals over.
you kind of always have to win the locals over. But it's funny because I like when I was a kid and you would hear Zeppelin lore and they would talk about Robert Plant and his buddy. Or was it the other way around? I guess it was the other way around. It was John Bonham had a buddy that sang.
That's right, yes. And Bonham was in the band first.
Yeah, and they would call it, always call it like from the north.
Mm.
But if you looked at a map, it doesn't look that far north when you think north, but that's like without really having the geographic understanding of England when you're a kid from Seattle.
Small country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There certainly was like this incredible soulfulness out of those guys.
Oh, yeah.
Who else?
There's ELO,
mm-hmm.
Judas Priest,
mm-hmm.
Spencer Davis Group,
uh-huh.
Duran Duran. You know,
really? From Birmingham?
Yeah. Wow. The list goes on.
Uh-huh.
Why, around here, not too sure, but yeah, incredible musical heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. Now, actually, you and I have something in common because you've interviewed Jimmy Page.
Yes.
Now, I know you're a fan. As
absolutely,
am I.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with Zeppelin. It sort of, you know, mm-hmm. shaped my musical path. When you interviewed Jimmy, were you as scared as I was?
Yes and no. I had dinner with him two nights earlier, where it was just he and I. And I just started talking to him, and I was asking him questions just to see, because he doesn't talk about personal stuff ever. And by the way, who cares? Because there's no reason to. And this was me sort of helping him present a book. So I'm kind of there at his behest. So I don't have to, it's not really my job to be a journalist and try to get him to cry on the couch. But, at the dinner, he would talk about anything and his stories were fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And he was so enthusiastic about just the subject of music in the broad sense, no matter what we were talking about. And it was really great. Once it was in front of a lot of people, it wasn't quite as relaxed. but it was still great. And I had picked photos out of his book of photos without telling him, and he didn't have to approve them or anything. It wasn't like that. It was just, I chose 32 or something, and then we just basically, I would just press a button and it would advance to the next one, and yeah. He would just discuss what that was. And he seemed really happy with what the choices were. And all I did really was try to stay away from the ones that everyone has seen a million times. And there were some really interesting ones in there. But it was a little nerve-wracking. I mean, the guy is super smart. And I did, somewhere in there, and I don't know how I did this because I do know this history, but I brought up Rolling Stone magazine. And he kind of just leapt off that one. Rolling Stone, what? Hate it. They suck. And then another thing I did. Oh, the other thing I did was I was sort of recounting, because we'd gotten to a certain point in sort of the chronologically in the history of Zeppelin. And this is in front of the audience. And I said something, so you know, it's this year, you guys. And what I was fascinated about was how far they advanced music in such a short period of time, but also during a year when I don't think people realized when they were writing songs for Zeppelin One, what else was coming out then. You know, it was literally on the heels of Sgt. Pepper, and what they were doing was crazy.
Yeah.
So I was trying to talk about that, and I said something to the effect of, so it's this year, and you're in the studio, and you're making this record, and you have no producer. And as soon as that came out of my mouth, I sort of braced for the reaction. He goes, I was the producer. We had a producer. It was me. And I was like, oh, God, why did I say something so stupid?
It was a good interview, though. I must admit, I cribbed a little bit from it. Because I was doing my interview a couple of weeks later, so I did use yours as a bit of research. So okay. thank you for that.
Sure.
Let's talk about the solo tour. You're in Birmingham tonight.
Mm-hmm.
A great venue, by the way, as well. The Symphony Hall. I don't know. I presume you sound checked or whatever, but the acoustics in here are insanely good.
Yes, that's sort of part of what this tour, I think, or at least it's somewhat of the aim of it, and that kind of started with the songbook tour and just the acoustic tours in general, is that once I did the first one in the US, I figured out that the room is really kind of, it's one of the most important things. To me, I want it to be an event. I want it to be a concert. I don't want it to be an acoustic show at a bar, for example, or a club, and the number, you know, I don't want people standing. I want them seated in a nice, comfortable environment that sounds great, because I think that's the difference between playing 2 hours and 45 minutes to an audience that's alive at the end of that and super happy, or an audience that's been standing for 2 hours and 45 minutes and they're still into it, but they're kind of also tired and happy that it's over, you know, that kind of thing. That you can't expect people to stand and listen to a guy playing songs on an acoustic guitar for 2.5 hours. I don't think.
It's very civilized, this approach as well. It's very nice.
Well, I think it's better.
Yeah.
And I also think that I felt like the performances became, everything about it, surrounding it, became sort of more churchy and it brought on a component that really sort of seemed to work once I was paying a little bit of attention to what the rooms are. And it wasn't that hard to do, really. I just had to kind of threaten the agents with, you know, don't let me take this tour. Is really important to me, and it's really important to my fans, and I don't want to get it wrong in any city. You know, it's not it's wrong to get it wrong, basically.
Were you aware when you sort of, you know, came across this idea? Because I think I read that this was born out of, you did an Audio Slave radio station acoustic session or something. That was sort of the inspiration for you to go out and do these solo shows. Was that right?
Even the period in the Audio Slave set where I would go play a couple acoustic songs, which goes all the way back to Soundgarden. Somewhere in there, I think it was the song Mind Riot that was on Louder Than Love. It was the guitar was tuned in like three octaves of E, and we couldn't get two guitars to do that where they were in tune with each other. It just didn't work. It sounded horrible. So I would do it alone. And what happened was, it was a nice reprieve, you know, from the onslaught. It seemed to actually elevate the set a little bit. And so I brought that up in Audioslave, like, here's one thing that kind of worked. And so I started doing like a 2-3-4 song medley on the acoustic guitar in Audioslave. And it was interesting. It wasn't particularly good, but I liked it. And that got me into kind of doing some different cover songs and things that I could throw out there that they wouldn't expect, because I was having fun with it. And it also gave me the idea to do the promo event, which was in Stockholm, Sweden, where I played an hour. And it was just an hour of kind of any songs I wanted to, including some of the new songs from the third Audioslave album. And I felt like I was going to get away with it for about 45 minutes, and then the last 15 minutes, people would be talking, or there'd be restlessness, and that didn't happen.
Well, these shows, from what I've heard, that, you know, 2-2.5 hours, I can see your set list here. I mean, were you surprised? Obviously, you've got this rich and varied back catalogue you can pull from. You've got Audioslave, Soundgarden as well. Were you surprised by some of the songs that have sort of translated to this sort of stripped back style? Were there some of them where you thought, oh, I didn't realise that one would work so well, but it has?
Yeah, a lot of them. And also, I would be surprised that maybe that didn't happen immediately. Maybe I had to play it 10 times first. You know, whereas it started out with as something that was fine, but then after playing it 10 times acoustically, suddenly it evolved into what actually really is great acoustically. Some of them are obvious, you know, where they just seem to lend themselves to that right away. Some of them seem to me to they took some massaging, but then ended up being really great.
I mean, one that interests me a lot, which I haven't heard yet, is One, which I understand is U2's One. Is that the music, but with the lyrics of Metallica's One?
Yes.
I mean, how did that come to be? Was that just something that was just, it just hit you?
I Google searched it, assuming that the U2's lyrics would come up first because the song's so huge, and I clicked on it, and it was Metallica's. Right. I wasn't really paying attention. I'm sort of ADD and just typed it in, enter, clicked on the first thing that came up without reading it, you know. And oftentimes, like with those lyric sites, even if the band has printed lyrics, because it happens to me all the time, they'll put them up wrong, like way wrong, amazingly wrong.
Yeah.
So when I was reading the first line, it seemed wrong, and I thought, oh, so somebody's printed it wrong, because oftentimes, you know, anyone can put them on there. Fans do it, and they think they know and they don't reference it. But then I realized that the phrasing was different, and then I looked at it, listed the writers' names, and then I realized, oh, that's Metallica's song.
Yes.
And then I thought, well, maybe I should try to edit it in a way that worked. And it was actually fairly easy.
Yeah.
The phrasing actually didn't. I didn't have to change much, and I managed to get almost all of the Metallica lyrics to fit within the context of the U2 arrangement without editing the U2 arrangement musically at all. Well, it's exactly the length.
I'm very excited to hear that tonight.
Oh, good.
I am indeed. And my wife will be happy to see a day in the life as well.
Oh, good.
So, it should be good. Just quickly, because I know you've got to get on stage soon. What's next for you? You know, is there Soundgarden? Is there an album you're working on at the moment? I've sort of read little bits and pieces on the net.
Yeah, we're sort of in the middle of writing an album.
Yeah.
And we've had a couple of sessions, and it's pretty fun. We've got quite a bit going already, so.
Excellent. So when do you think we might see that? Will that be next year?
No idea. Yeah.
All right.
Probably next year, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to it, as I'm sure all your fans do.
Me too. Yeah.
All right. Chris Cornell, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Cheers, mate.
All right.